raised $25,000 to support our local arts and artists and keep our community informed with local news, concerts, and events listings on air and on our website. Visit CFRC.ca today and make your gift to Kingston's longest-running broadcaster serving our community since 1922. Get a tax receipt via Queen's University or get sweet CFRC swag and enter to win our weekly raffle draws featuring gifts from amazing local donors. For every $5 donated, you get one more chance to win. Thank you for your support.
G'day and welcome to Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is CJ the DJ and I am your host for this week's Grad Chat. Of course, a show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs, as well as CFRC. So thank you very much to both of them. Now, if your mates miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC Podcast. So no excuse not to hear what our awesome students and postdoctoral fellows are doing. Today, though, I would like to introduce you to Laura Ströber, who is doing a PhD in Geological Sciences under the supervision of Dr. Ryan Mulligan and Dr. Pierre Pufau. Welcome to Grad Chat, Laura. Again, I should say. Welcome again.
Yes, yeah, thank you for having me back. I'm very excited to be here.
Well, it has been a while since you came on the show, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it was before you were about to do your comprehensives or something, or just after?
Right before the comprehensive exams, I came on to chat about my research, yeah.
And so now, though, you're coming on and you have defended. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Pretty awesome.
Thank you.
Guess a lot has happened between your comps and now.
Yes, yeah, the research has evolved substantially, yeah.
And you've enjoyed the whole process?
Oh, yeah. I've loved my entire time being a PhD student. It's a little bit bittersweet for it to come to a close because I've enjoyed it so much. And I had so many opportunities to meet cool people and travel to nice places. But I'm also excited for the next step in my career.
Which will be?
I will be joining BGC Engineering as an earth scientist.
Fantastic.
At the Kingston office just downtown, so oh. I'm not going far.
Well, that's fortuitous, isn't
yeah.
it? You don't have to move too far, which, as you said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I'm very happy to be able to stay in Kingston.
And did you have opportunities to work with this company beforehand? Is that how you've managed to make this connection?
I made the connection because one of the employees for the company runs a course here at Queen's mm-hmm. through geological engineering called Five Hazards, and I came into the course for a guest lecture on coastal hazards, and so
okay.
that started the connection, and then I maintained that connection up until now.
Which just goes to show, you know, networking during your degree is super,
yes.
super important, and as you said, you know, you might just meet someone once, but it's, as we always learn in networking, keep that person in mind and reach out to them every now and then because you just never know
mm-hmm.
what's available for you around the corner.
Exactly. And it was really just a cold email that I sent to this individual to ask about the course and ask how I could be involved. So it all just starts with, you know, reaching out.
Reaching out.
Yeah.
Now we need to do more of that, particularly in this world.
Yes.
Where connections are really, really important. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, that was great that you learned that.
Thank you.
Now, coming back to your research, though, which you probably know really well now, since mm-hmm. you've defended it and everything, and just to remind people, it's on modern coastal processes.
Yes.
And looking, as it says, in coastal zones. I'm going to ask you a little bit about what does all that mean in terms of your research, because, you know, looking at the way coastal lines are eroding these days with mm-hmm. the craziness in our climate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't that long ago North Carolina had a huge storm and they were really worried about just on the normal news about erosion and things.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us a little bit about what you were actually trying to accomplish during your research.
Mm-hmm.
What was the main focus, really?
I focused on the erosion that's occurring along the Barrier Islands of North Carolina.
Okay, well, there you go.
Exactly, yeah. Specifically the developed portions. So I looked at Duck, North Carolina, and Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, and those are very popular tourist destinations. There's lots of homes and businesses that are settled along the Barrier Island. And whenever we have a lot of development in those coastal zones, we have to manage the sediment budget very carefully because we're anchoring these very dynamic landscapes in one spot.
Right.
And they really want to move. The sand wants to be washed onto the barrier island. The barrier island itself wants to move landwards over time.
Right.
But because we have so much invested in those areas, we have to keep it in that same spot. So what ends up happening is the shoreline itself starts to kind of fall into the ocean, essentially. And in response, these areas along North Carolina re-nourish their beaches every 3 to 5 years, where they dredge sand from offshore, pump it onto the shoreline, and then use bulldozers to spread it around. And that's a very costly process,
well,
and it's a never-ending process as well.
Well, one begs to ask the question, why are we building there when naturally the land doesn't want to do that, or the sea doesn't want to allow that to happen?
Well, the coastal zone is a very attractive area for recreation. It's also great for business. I think historically people settled along the coastline for navigation and ports and trade. So it's kind of just a legacy of, you know, the economics of the time, and then just also it's a beautiful area, so people naturally gravitate towards it. But it is becoming more and more challenging with sea level changes to stay in those areas. A lot of people are starting to put their homes on trucks and relocate their homes inland because in certain parts of the Outer Banks, homes are literally falling into the ocean, where the shoreline has reached the base of the homes and has eroded the foundation. And it becomes a very challenging problem for the communities to manage because there's a lot of debris and the septic tank is now outflowing into the ocean. And these are areas that people are swimming and enjoying themselves. And you have all of these new complications as this problem is becoming more critical.
Which, as you said, increases the cost of or the budgets of those particular townships and things.
Yes. And then that raises questions about access to the beach, because it's becoming more of a reality that in order to have access to the beach, you have to be wealthy. So you have to have the flood insurance. You have to have the capability to install the mitigation measures to protect your house. Maybe you have to move your house, or you have to help your community invest in these nourishment efforts. So it's becoming this kind of socioeconomic challenge as well, and an equity challenge. So there's all sorts of different layers when it comes to the coastal zone, which makes it a very fascinating area to study.
Well, yeah, because I guess it's constantly changing at the moment, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
And probably faster than perhaps it should be.
Definitely, yeah, the sea levels are rising at an accelerated rate. So it's not even just the eustatic sea level rise, which is just the elevation in water due to the additional meltwater from the glaciers,
right.
But you also have the land responding, and in some areas the land is sinking. So that's called relative sea level rise, and that's why in certain areas around the world the sea levels are rising faster. And it's because the land is sinking while simultaneously the sea level is rising.
There's going to be more Venices in the world.
Yes, yes. So, the sinking of the land can be due to groundwater withdrawal.
Right.
Another common kind of contributor is the isostatic adjustment of the land, which basically means that, you know, thousands of years ago we had glaciers kind of near Virginia, that area. And just south of those glaciers, the land was uplifted slightly because the glaciers were so heavy and had so much mass that they sank the land where they immediately overlapped. And so the surrounding areas, almost like a trampoline, bulged upwards.
Right.
And now the glaciers are gone. They've retreated. And so the land is slowly starting to readjust to that loss of mass. And so that response is also adding another layer of complexity.
Wow, because I hadn't even thought about the glaciers and what they could potentially
do.
Because I know you're looking at the coast and you think what's coming in from the sea. But you're right in the way that, you know, the land itself has had to move itself around.
Yeah.
And some of that's through glaciers, and some of it could have been from volcanoes, etc., that are popping up on land as opposed to in the sea?
Oh yeah, there's all sorts of different responses because the tectonic plates are really just floating on this kind of more plastic material underneath. So it is a little bit squishy. We can't really, we don't notice the squishiness in our day-to-day life, but you know, over the time scales of, you know, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of years, the squishiness is very important.
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, I know I'm going off the coast here a little bit, but even here in Kingston with all the limestone that we have, you can tell even in your own backyard that the limestone rocks are shifting and things because water's turning up in areas that hadn't turned up 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Because it's clearly found a different path.
Water will always find a path through rock and it can cause, erosion and the shifting of different, bedrock planes as well.
So that's, we clearly need to study rocks a little bit more, don't we?
Rocks are important.
rocks are important. Okay, so back to the beaches, your modern coastal processes. What is beach nourishment and why might a community nourish their beaches?
Beach nourishment is the artificial replacement of sand. So the community has identified that an intervention is needed.
Right.
And there's other options, but they're usually kind of gray infrastructure options like seawalls or revetments or bulkheads, things like that. But in a lot of areas where recreation is important, you want it to remain as natural looking as possible and you want a nice large beach for people to enjoy. So oftentimes nourishment is your best bet. However, because you are kind of artificially redesigning the profile of the beach, the sea wants to bring it back into that original equilibrium.
Right.
So inevitably, whenever a nourishment project occurs, it is expected that the sand will not stay there forever. It's going to move.
So all that sand they're dumping in every few years, as you said, is eventually going to go back into the sea.
It's either going to go back into the sea, which is called cross-shore transport, so moving it back towards the ocean, or it can move down the shoreline. So one community nourishing their beach can actually benefit the communities down the shoreline because there's a very strong current that runs along the shoreline, parallel to the shoreline, and that continuously draws sand south in my field site. So the longshore current runs south. Like I said, it's kind of a never-ending process. Once you start, it's really hard to stop nourishing your beach.
So talk about these currents, because I know coming from Australia, whenever we go in the sea, we're always told by the lifeguard people, watch out for the currents and the rips and things like that. So there's the currents, but then there's the rips where you can get caught.
Yeah.
Tell us about how this works, because you said they have a current that runs kind of like parallel. But are they strong currents? Do they have rips in them? And what effect does the rip actually have?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So there's lots of nearshore currents. And the two directions that most people study are moving offshore. Those are the cross-shore currents, and then moving along the shoreline. The ones that run along the shoreline occur primarily within the surf zone. So if you're at a beach, at a sandy beach with lots of waves, and you're playing in the waves, you may notice that if you look up, you're moving slowly or rapidly down the shoreline.
Yeah, sometimes rapidly, which is the scary one.
Yeah, because they can be upwards of, 2 meters a second. So if you're not paying attention, you may end up, several land parcels down away from where you originally entered the ocean.
Or getting closer to the rocks.
Or getting closer to the rocks, exactly. You really need to pay attention. But every once in a while, that a longshore current reroutes itself and escapes back out towards the ocean. And those are commonly known as rip currents. And those are quite scary because people, can feel that they're being pulled farther and farther away from the shoreline. Oftentimes, they try to, fix the situation by swimming right back towards land. But because it's a very steady and strong current, they can end up exhausting themselves. And that's why rip currents are so hazardous to swimmers.
So what should they do? Because I've been caught in a rip and I did exactly what you said I shouldn't do.
Yeah,
which is why I had to get rescued.
It's very scary. It's not a great feeling.
No, it's not.
Well, the first thing that swimmers can do is to swim in areas with lifeguards.
Yes.
So pay attention to what the lifeguards are saying. Pay attention to if there's any flags up. If you don't understand what a flag is, ask the lifeguard, what does this mean for the conditions for the day? Because oftentimes they will mark the locations where rip currents are currently happening or may happen. So the other thing to keep in mind is that there's been lots of research on how to respond to rip currents effectively. There was a recent study that came out where they put kind of GPS trackers on swimmers.
Oh.
And they were very strong swimmers. And they told them, you know, to either swim parallel to the shoreline or to rest and just kind of allow the current to take them where it may.
Right.
And they actually found that in many cases, these rip currents can recirculate back towards the surf zone on the time scale of about 7 to 10 minutes. So if you're willing to kind of just...
To hope.
Yeah, if you're willing to rest, you may end up just recirculating back towards the surf zone, but slightly kind of away from the rip current and kind of plumes outwards and curls back towards the shoreline. Because also keep in mind that the rip current isn't going to suck you out, you know, kilometers away from the shoreline. It really only escapes about one extra length away from the surf zone. So if you look at the width of a surf zone, the rip current will die off really rapidly as soon as you exit the surf zone. And you can still feel it a little bit, but it spreads out and it slows down a lot as soon as you leave the surf zone. And they found that actually only in 10% of cases did the swimmers actually get sucked out outside of the surf zone. Mm. So the general advice when you're in a rip current is to not swim back towards the shoreline, which that's true.
So don't fight it.
Don't fight the current. First thing to do is relax, kind of pay attention to where you may be going. The next thing to do is to consider, if you're a strong enough swimmer, to swim parallel to the shoreline. So ideally that is running, you know, perpendicular to the rip current itself.
Right.
However, there are still longshore currents. And in some cases, those longshore currents can also be strong. So you need to make sure that you're not fighting the rip, but you're also not fighting the longshore current. So I would say if you're finding yourself caught in a rip, to, you know, take a moment to float and calm down and analyze your trajectory. Are you moving rapidly offshore and are you moving downshore? And then to swim with, you know, in tandem with that longshore current. So to allow the longshore current to help you escape the rip current, as opposed to choosing the wrong shore parallel location. Now you're fighting a different sort of current.
Right.
So it is a little bit complicated to do it, you know, very efficiently and effectively.
So at the end of the day, keep an eye on what the lifeguards tell you.
Yes, yeah.
And you don't get caught in that.
Yeah, and if you're in an area that's not lifeguarded, but you still want to swim, what you can do is assess the area before you enter the water, because in many cases, the rip currents are occurring in locations where there's a gap in the sandbar.
And that's what I always remembered. There was you get sand when you're in the surf. You have these sandbars, but then you have these deep trenches.
Exactly.
So it's the trench, right?
Yes, that trench acts as basically a drain pipe for any water that wants to move offshore. It's going to route right through that channel. It's called a rip channel. And so usually you can see lots of foamy breaking waves over those sandbars. Mm-hmm. And then there's often a gap in the breaking waves. So there's less foam. The waves actually, to an untrained eye, it looks like the perfect spot to go swimming because you don't see those crashing waves. You don't see the turbulence.
Right.
But in fact, if you look very closely, in some cases, you can see residual foam moving very slowly out towards the sea. Or you can even see sediment plumes. So the color of the water may change because the rip current is kind of excavating and bringing up a whole bunch and entraining a whole bunch of sediment into the water column. So there's a couple of clues that you can look for before you enter the water to avoid a rip current.
So, I mean, it's great now and I know what I should have done. But in terms of erosion of the coastal line, so if we've got these trenches and they're picking up sediment and chucking it out, is that why having these rip currents are not good for the coast as well? Or is it good to have them?
Well, that's a good question.
In terms of erosion.
Generally speaking, rip currents kind of pop up in random and different locations, and they do pull sediment offshore. And depending on the strength of the rip current, they may pull the sediment sufficiently offshore that it's difficult to recover that sediment back.
Okay.
So sometimes the rip current is so fast that it's bringing the sediment really far offshore, and the sediment will never see the beach ever again.
Right.
And like I said, usually the rip currents are not in one location steady over time. However, there are certain areas along the Outer Banks where rip currents do seem to be reinforced by the natural geology of the area. So rip currents are more likely in those zones. And when you have that sort of situation, then you're more continuously transporting that sediment offshore where it can be a problem.
So what are those geological things that make them more often, happen more often?
That's a really good question. So the underwater topography is referred to as bathymetry.
Oh, that's a good word.
Is influenced by, you know, geological bedrock sequences that were established a long time ago. And in my study site at Kitty Hawk, there's a sequence of very strange undulations in the bathymetry.
Oh.
We call them shore oblique bars and troughs because they're basically kind of these permanent sandbars and channels that connect to the shoreline at an angle. And we find that in those areas, especially if there's really high wave heights, so maybe a 2 meter size wave or higher, that those like geological structures end up inducing the conditions to create rip currents like fairly frequently in the exact same position.
Right. And so that's not helping with the erosion at all.
And at a regional scale, those geological signatures have been statistically linked to higher rates of erosion. But it's difficult to study the exact dynamics and the exact processes in detail because it's such a spatially continuous zone. Waves, especially stormy conditions, are challenging to study safely. And so my research aimed to investigate those dynamics with a combination of modeling and remote sensing. So those were some good strategies to use in this particular case.
So, but how does that work if you've got sensors and things? Because if it's constantly changing, I mean, I guess the sensors are picking that up. Mm-hmm. But it's still a fairly big area, isn't it? And who knows what's happening with storms, and even without storms, the normal movements of the sea, tides, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were no installed sensors in the ocean at Kitty Hawk, but there are sensors kind of scattered around the surrounding area. So particularly Duck, North Carolina has a series of sensors permanently installed because it's a site studied by the Army Corps of Engineers.
Okay.
And the sensors are from 4 meters depth all the way out to kind of really offshore deep depths. And they do have to be maintained fairly regularly because, you know, they can get buried under kind of extreme conditions. Mm-hmm. But biofouling is another challenge whenever we're dealing with sensors in the ocean. Biofouling. Yeah, basically like mussels and clams and different living organisms can encrust themselves. And then also just salt. Salt water is really challenging. So it is, you know, it is difficult to maintain any sort of permanent sensor fields in the ocean. But I really just use those installed sensors to calibrate my numerical model to make sure that my model is matching what those sensors are saying at those really, you know, because the sensors are only covering a very small point in space. So I can calibrate my numerical model to make sure that those points in space are accurate. And then you kind of assume that the model is resolving the relevant dynamics properly. And that's essentially what I did. So I calibrated the model and then analyzed Kitty Hawk. And then I also had a radar, a remote sensing system out to capture several storm events. And that is something that sits kind of along the dune line and can just kind of send out electromagnetic signals, and it records the backscatter of those signals. And it turns out that the radar data is really good at picking up the crests of waves. So I can actually track each individual wave that's approaching the coastline and how it's bending, how it's breaking. And that, paired with the numerical model, really offered a lot of insights into what's happening at Kitty Hawk.
And then once you've got that model, then you can look and say, you know, if we get, for instance, a storm of this caliber with the waves at this height, this is the expected erosion. Is that what you basically you're trying to do?
Yeah, exactly. So my first couple of kind of research pieces used a model that just had a static bed. And then the last half of my dissertation, we used a different model that can actually simulate the movement of the sediment. Mm-hmm. But that's a little bit more of a challenging process because not only are you trying to get the waves and the currents correct, but you're also trying to make sure that the sediment is moving in a way that makes sense and is accurate and representative. But we did find, we resolved a series of representative storms. So we wanted storms of various intensities and various durations. So we simulated a whole sequence, and we found that the storm conditions really controlled the volume or the magnitude of sediment that was being moved. But those bathymetric features, those oblique bars and troughs, really controlled the locations where erosion was intense and where deposition or where the placement of sediment was intense.
So it's interesting that you're doing this because, I mean, you certainly can't do this on every beach in up and down the East Coast of North America or any other place, to be honest. So what are you hoping to gain from this knowledge? You just help those particular communities, or is it something that then can be looked at to be used in other places that have the potential to have a major effect on humans? And then everything else in between.
I think kind of the global takeaway from the research is to acknowledge that kind of geological structures and the bathymetry of the ocean can play a role in really exacerbating erosion in local spots.
Right.
So if a community has elected to manage erosion, it's really good to keep in mind that you may have this kind of persistent feature that's just going to make your life difficult forever.
Right.
And we do find very similar geological structures occurring around the world. So because these structures were originally created by really old paleo riverine channels that ran through coastal zones during the last glacial maximum.
Okay.
So during the last glacial maximum, sea levels were much lower because all the water was stored in the glaciers. And therefore, where presently we have coastal areas, it was riverine areas. So rivers ran through these areas once, you know, long ago. And so we're finding very similar structures in Florida, in Texas, all along North Carolina, also Long Island. And then there's a very interesting study that came out of PEI, and it's not an ancient riverine channel that is kind of inducing these rip currents. It's actually an old river that we engineered to reroute in order to place a road and a parking lot for beach access. So they rerouted this river, moved it into a kind of pond that gets outflowed to the ocean at a different location. And it's very interesting. They used satellite imagery to track the location of rip currents, and they found that rip currents were continuously happening at the old outflow of the original river location.
Right.
So it can happen under a variety of circumstances via a variety of means, but it's just good to keep in mind that the topography underneath the water that we don't often pay attention to can be kind of reinforcing certain hydrodynamic conditions.
Well, I think it comes down to the usual. Sometimes we shouldn't upset the natural balance.
Yeah.
You know, if a river says it wants to go here, let it.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, as you showed in that PEI, moving it to even only 10 meters or even 100 meters can have a huge impact.
Exactly. And it's kind of a very interesting story because they moved the river to make a beach access point and then they encountered these rip currents. It's like, oh shoot, like this is not great.
It'd be interesting to see if they moved it back, got rid of that, you know, moved the river back to where it was, whether it would fix itself again.
That's a very interesting question. Yeah, they'd have to change kind of the beach access point, but yeah.
Which is probably the better thing, what they should have done in the first place. Well, you got plenty plenty to do.
Yes.
And, you know, Laura, I really appreciate you coming back on the show because it's...
Thank you.
To be honest, this is one of those topics too, which affects all of us really because we do love the shoreline.
Yeah.
We do love going to the beach.
Mm-hmm.
We may not like always the salt water, but we do like going to the beach.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be a shame if we could never... enjoy the beach. As long as we do our due diligence of looking after and not contributing to erosion, which unfortunately human beings are very good at contributing. So thank you.
Thank you.
Congrats again.
Thank you.
It's always exciting when I know someone's defended. So that's great.
It's a good feeling.
And good luck with the new job. I hope you're enjoying it.
Thank you.
Good luck with that.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat sadly comes to an end. Don't forget you can download the show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC Podcast. Just type in a Grad Chat. Until next week, this is CJ the DJ signing off with a big hooray. Grad Chat. Grad Chat.
Hello, CFRC listeners. This is Christina Laurie, CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative news reporter. CFRC's annual funding drive campaign is now underway through December 31st, and you can help CFRC keep our listeners informed on issues that matter with modernized broadcasting equipment and trained team members. Help CFRC hit our $25,000 fundraising goal this year by donating today at cfrc.ca.
You're listening to Kingston's only campus community radio station, broadcasting 24/7, 365 on 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca. Tune in for the best local programming.
Sego.
Buju Anim.
Danach A. At Anzenu Shukwithan.
Tanse.
Ay, Inuhadikai.
This is Words and Culture, a series on Indigenous languages, funded by SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.
Danach'a. My name is Christine Genier, and I am your host for the Athabaskan episodes of Words and Culture. Danu sho kwithan shan shang shen anije danke. Arun aga jalich e. Eshgraf Chan Tan Mangqua Chanye Tagish Chanye Shinget Ye Kuch Ane Huanlin Noshindim Ye Tagish Koshe Kat Ine Yedachwanje Koshe Kat Ine Tan Quachan Quinje. I am a Wolf Clan woman. I am a citizen of the Tan Quachan Council, our modern day government, and one of the 14 First Nations in the Yukon, 11 of which are self governing. I was born and raised on Da Kei, our ancestral lands, blessed with a big family, steeped in language and culture. Of course, back in the 70s, 80s, I don't know how much of it we were identifying as culture, so much as we were just living. Descriptions and categorizations of such would come later. And I didn't know then that what we had was an embarrassment of riches. I still live here in Kuanlin, what is also known as White Horse Yukon, just above the 60th parallel here in Canada. We are often confused with Yellowknife in the Northwest Territories, and sometimes folks even think we're all the way over in Alaska. There was a time, though, not long ago when those borders weren't there, and we were able to visit and trade with our relations with ease. We have other ways of looking at the land, but those new borders, they changed the way we do business. So it all depends on the lens. We do have family and relations in Northwest Territories and Alaska and British Columbia. My family languages are Dakhwanje, Tangkwachan Kwinje, and Tagish Koshe. They are two of the indigenous language families in the Yukon. One of the eight language groups, seven are Athabaskan. Now, that other language is Tlingit, a coastal language, not of the Athabaskan language groups. We do have Tlingit in our line, as my grandfather was a Tlingit man. But we don't follow our father's ways. We honor our father's people, and we follow our mother's ways. We're a matrilineal people. These languages are categorized now as Athabaskan. Athabaskan in and of itself is a term that was bastardized from a Cree language name for Lake Athabasca. If you talk to the people, you will hear it called Dene or Dena Koshe, Dana Koshe, some variations of that. So I encourage you to speak to the people and listen to the people if you want to know how these languages are called. growing up, from what I can remember in the 70s, and then the 80s and the 90s, I would hear my grandparents, my mom, my aunties and uncles speak to each other. And the way that it happens with children, it just wasn't something I thought about too much as being a different language. As I started getting older, I would begin to understand what was happening with our languages, and I would ask mom to teach me what she could. Our parents were teachers, but not in the way things were being taught in school, so it was difficult to transfer the language if we weren't already speaking it. Now that's one of the reasons. There are a lot of reasons why language was not directly transferred in my generation. All of those reasons are colonization. So when we were kids, it was all around us and it wasn't taught to us. I remember every now and then, Grandma, sometimes she would ask, Danjanta, do you speak? Do you hear me? Now, because I understood that specific question, I would say yes, not understanding the implication of what was being asked, not understanding what was happening, not understanding what my grandmother was witnessing in her time, what my mom and her siblings were witnessing in their time, and what I would come to witness in my time. As such, we all have our parts in the story, and I can only speak to mine. In 2021, the world was just coming back together, or trying to, when I was attending the fall gathering of the Council of Yukon First Nations. They had a big tent set up on the shores of Ta'anmun. Now, if you look at a map, it'll say Lake LaBarge because they haven't caught up to us yet. I ran into Tina Jules, Skaidau, and we talked, a beautiful talk about language work. Now at the time, Skaidau was the executive director at the Yukon Native Language Center. Skaidau is from Teslin, Yukon, and is pursuing a doctorate in education. Like many of our people, she is receiving her education through two lenses. That's when I started teaching at the Yukon Native Language Center with my mom as my mentor. While Skaidau has since left that position to lead the school in Burwash, she now has returned to YNLC for 1 year on secondment to help with curriculum development. I asked Tina, why, she asked me all those years ago, to come in and talk about language. I found her at the Yukon Native Language Center and brought her some coffee.
Skaidau, ak anzenusho kwithan, kuchundi ani, yeah, good day to you. I brought you some coffee. Would you like some?
Ah, goodness, jeez, kahwe ak tuwa sigu, ah, clean. Ak tuwu, yak e, ak wasatini, ak honi.
Jokwayani, it is really good to see you.
Ah, Skaidau, you khatu sa klinga kainach. Tina Jules, you chut do a sock, late cock, ainach. Daklasha, I a chut. Klingit shawat, chutsati, deslin dach. Chwat, chwat, chwa good, ko ah, tagish, ach, nechlisati. Ach, chut yak, eh, ah, ye dat. Ka, gunnish chish de kion kau. Cajun yegi haji tiati. My Tlingit name is Skaidau, and my English name is Tina Jules, or they call me Tina Jules. I exist as a Tlingit woman. I'm from the Eagle Clan and from Teslin. I live in Tagish right now.
I remember being out at the fall gathering, I think, for Council for Yukon First Nations, and 2020, 2021. You know, these last few years are a little mixed up for a lot of us. You were doing some work here at the Yukon Native Language Center. And he said, I want you to come and do some work. So I thought, if the Words and Culture would like me to introduce myself as host, why I do the work I do, I need to go to the person and ask them, why did you ask me? Yay, ka!
I'm thinking back to that time out there on the beautiful traditional lands of the Ta'an, Gwich'in Council people. And I just remember talking to you, and I think we were talking about colonialism and decolonialism and moving past that eventually, noting that we are not, past the colonial era yet. And I just felt like I met my sister. I just knew that there was a bond there, and that you were the kind of person we needed working in language that could see that we've been living within colonial fences, and that we had to think and do outside of those fences to move our language forward so that we could regain our languages again.
Because I have a lot of gratitude. I think about that conversation a lot. For me, it seems that when we're asked to talk about language work, there's a big difference between choosing to learn, say, one of the romantic languages, Italian, Francais, Espanol, maybe, versus how we approach this and why we approach it the way we do. What brought you to language work? First of all, what are the languages you work in?
In my career, I've worked with all 8 of our Yukon First Nation languages, supporting them indirectly, and I guess really focused on trying to help build capacity at the community level so that we have somewhat of our own centers there based on what that community wants and what they say they need. So in that sense, I've been involved with all the languages. And way back when, I initially started out being a consultant at the Department of Education, supporting, I think it was 28 schools back then, and the language programs that existed in schools. What brought me into languages? Well, I really believe at this point in my life that it's Creator and our ancestors that plant that seed in you before you're even born. And I think you even choose the parents and the family and the community that's going to support the nurturing of whatever that seed is to grow. I did not know that when I was younger. So I went venturing off in the domain, I guess you'd say, or sector of education, which is connected to language for sure. Yeah, I ended up getting my Bachelor of Education degree and ended up teaching. And then I found myself noticing, because the anti-racism decolonization was not a part of my post-secondary education and becoming a teacher. But once I was in the classroom, I started noticing that the kids that were struggling tended to be in elementary school, First Nation boys around grade 4 or 5, we'd start to lose them. Mm-hmm. And then at the high school level, I was teaching an alternative program, and 100% of my students were First Nation. And I knew there was a problem with that. But I ended up going to apply for a teaching position in Lytton, BC, because I wanted to work in a First Nation education system. And I was bold enough to let a few higher-ups at the department know I was leaving the system because I felt that it was not serving First Nation students very well. And lo and behold, a certain big bird came to visit me and said, come and work with all our language teachers in the Yukon. I was like, why do you want me? I don't speak our language. And he said to help them to teach, like, go see what you can do. And he said, I think you can make a difference. And I was like, thought about it. And I thought, 8 languages, like, could I make a difference? So I said, okay, I'll try. And the weird thing is, I seen the challenges that our teachers had in the system, all the inequities that they lived with on a day-to-day basis of trying to teach our languages. I think a lot of those inequities are still in place today, actually. But I was walking down the hall one day at the Department of Ed, and one of our friends, Shanlea, I won't say her English name on here, she said, hey, there's a master's degree program starting in Boardroom 1. There's a seat available. You should apply. And I was like, well, how do I get in? She goes, just go in there. So I did, and I sat there, and I thought, this looks interesting. So I talked to the guy that seemed in charge there, and lo and behold, I got into that program. And the strangest thing was that I wrote a letter to Simon Fraser University back then, or an email. I can't remember who I sent it to. Was complaining about their program, that it was a a graduate program, yeah. A Yukon cohort on the lands of First Nations people, Kwanlin, Dun, and Ta'an. And why didn't I have Yukon First Nation instructors or Yukon First Nation content? I had, you know, what were they going to do about it? And lo and behold, Dr. Marianne Ignace told me years later that somebody handed her this email and said, can you contact this woman? So she did, and she talked to me about what I was interested in, which was back then looking at our education system. And she said, why don't you write a lit review on language revitalization? It's connected to our students doing well or better in education. So I did. And that's when I started really learning about immersion education, about the Hawaiian programs, the Maori programs, and so forth. And that's when I also really learned about myself. Mm-hmm. It was like I was turned inside out a bit. In my life, I went through some tough times. And one of those tough times was when I lost my daughter. And there was a morning when our clan leader found a baby eagle that was dead under a tree outside my house, and he took care of it in our own way. And I never stopped to think what that might mean. I was so busy with life. Mm-hmm. And then I kept dreaming of a baby hanging upside down, covered in blood, and I thought, it's just a dream. Part of my work at the department, when I started working with all the different teachers in the Yukon and the different languages, was me learning my own language as well through mentor apprentice. And this is where I really have to acknowledge Waksani, Yudusog, and Fingakinak, Emma Sam is what they used to call her in English. She was my language mentor, and I'd spend up to 10 hours per week with her. And I started to not only benefit from having Ach'at, she told me to call her my aunt. I really benefited from having her as my best friend. And not just a mentor, my best friend. I started learning so much about being Tlingit Shawat Chetziti. Through learning my language more and more, I really move beyond the rhetoric, because when I wrote in my graduate degree that our language is who we are and all of that stuff, I don't think I really felt it. I didn't understand it. But in my journey in learning my language, I know now that it's like my sense of identity as a Tlingit woman was tied up in my language. And the more and more I learned, the more and more it came back to me. And I started to understand that if I had known my language, I would have known our ways, our protocol, our spiritual practices, our ceremonies, and maybe I could have understood more what finding a baby eagle outside my house was about, and my dreams, more what those were, rather than thinking it was just a dream or just something that happened. I would have understood if I had known my language, because I would have known my culture at a deeper level and believed in my own spirituality. I would have understood that I needed to take heed. And so learning my language hasn't been just learning my language. It's been learning who I am. And my roots grow deeper and deeper and deeper. And to me, I always thought about being kind of like a coniferous tree. And no matter what winds blow in life, no matter how hard the rain comes down in life, no matter how cold it gets, I think your language, the deeper and deeper your roots are, that tree's still going to stand there. And I almost fell over. I did for a while, but I came back up. And I thought, that's what I want for our children. I want them to be that strong, that resilient, and not to struggle like that.
This is what I'm talking about when I ask and try to talk about the differences between our language recovery work and just being interested in language for the sake of learning it. What all informs this? Because as you discovered, as we discover, this generation in between those who held the language from birth and this generation coming up behind us, I feel we kind of fall in this middle, that what people have called the silent speakers. We've heard the language around us. It wasn't taught directly. The people who spoke it around us didn't have to recover it. It happened that recently in the Yukon, that we are only one generation or two, and we're in a very, very precarious position at the moment, and we have to you know, as our non-Indigenous relations say, we have to make hay while the sun shines. That's it. Right now, we have a really unique opportunity here. And it creates a reality that's difficult to explain if you don't already know it. This isn't a hobby. This isn't a field of study. This isn't an academic interest. This is vital to our emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being, to be able to read the world around us. And I have found that people who have come to their languages in a very direct, deliberate lens of learning, for me, I recognize that I didn't have to start learning. It had always been in the home. We just didn't talk about it the same way we do in the 2020s, back in the 1970s and 80s. There's a very, like, as you said, the rhetoric around it has changed. So that was a huge comfort, that I already knew much. It just wasn't, you know, this is Dahuanje, this is English. French, that was a very specific, this is French, this is English. And what I came to find was that we're not learning our languages. We are being reminded of the language that is already within us.
That's right. I think it's also being reminded of who we are in the deepest sense. And I guess I should say, too, that like you, Ahuni, my friend, I heard language. My finger language around me when I was a child, my grandmother would just come get me, right? And she would just come and get me, my sister. It was no permission needed.
No.
And she didn't speak much English. So, and we were happy together. So, you know, I remember hearing language, and it's the strangest thing. I still remember some phrases. I did not know what they were when I was younger, but I know what they are now. So that's an interesting phenomena, I guess, if you want to call it that. And I also heard her talking a lot to my aunties, her sisters. And it wasn't until I was in junior high, back then they had junior high, that I actually went to my first second language class. But really pulling the language together was through the Mentor Apprentice Program for me. Yeah.
I like how you had put that. There were sentences we didn't know weren't English.
Mm-hmm.
And that did happen in our generation, I mm-hmm. believe. And I am so grateful for that now, because, you know, with a directed language capture, if you will, I'm going to sit down and do this now.
Mm-hmm.
I have found that nothing feels foreign to me. It all feels like home. Hmm. It all feels like home. And that is the privilege I feel like I have. Mom was always very careful with me, especially after I started my liberal arts education. I would talk about white privilege a lot. And she goes, you know, you talk about this white privilege a lot, but I really hope you start talking about the Indigenous privilege you grew up with. And man, she only ever had to say that once because it made so much sense. We were very privileged. That is one of my privileges, that it never felt foreign. It always felt like home.
You know, going back to what we call education, I know that we didn't fragment life like that, like education, justice, mm-hmm. language. That's a colonial construct. One thing I knew back then is if those were our young boys, we wouldn't be treating them that way. Mm-hmm. That's where I really started to first learn that feel, I guess. It was a feeling before I started learning how to be an advocate, a gut feeling that this wasn't right.
So that, you just said the word, that too is how it is different for us to do this work. When you are learning a language that has a whole country supporting it, and probably several if that country decided to colonize other areas, you don't need to advocate for the language. That's a full-time job in and of itself. So you're doing that. You're advocating for the recovery and the survival of a language that is described as being lost. But let's, if we're going to, let's do this then.
Yeah.
It wasn't lost. Our language wasn't lost. It was torn violently from the throats of our grandparents.
That's right.
That was part of my conversation with Tina Jules Skaidau. Skaidau is from Teslin, Yukon, and is a principal with one of our elementary schools in the communities, also working with the Yukon Native Language Center on helping to build curriculum for language transfer. I always love working with Skaidau, either running into her at work or when we just run into each other, because we can get lost for hours, and often do, talking about language, where we come from, where we are now, and where we're going and what we need to get there. And part of what we need to get there is the lens that Skaidau brings on what children require for comfortable, sustainable, and traditional language transfer. Each week, we're going to learn three new words or concepts. Before I get to that, I want to tell you something. I want to share with you what Mom always told me, and in fact, told anybody who was coming to language. If you only know two words, use them. Use them, use them, use them all the time. It makes your elders happy. It makes your elders happy when you use the words that you do know. And then when you learn two more words, guess what? You know twice as much as you did before. What is something we all talk about? It's the weather. So that's what I usually start out with as well. What's the weather like out there? We have to know for all sorts of reasons. Maybe we're going out on the land. Heck, maybe we're just going down to the mall. We still want to know what it's looking like out there. So in Tagish Koshe, we say, Tujani Dakot E, when we want to know what the weather is like outside. Tujani Dakot E. Tujani Dakot E. Tujani Dakot E. And I hope wherever you're listening from, that sun is shining down on you. So you would say, Shakwan Li. Shakwan Li. Sha Kwen Li. I'm going to leave you with this closing thought. In April of 2023, I lost my language mentor, my teacher, my colleague, my elder, my mother. It has been a quiet year for me, and as such, it has been difficult for me to talk both in language and about language. Where for many years it would bring me a lot of joy and a lot of peace, I now feel lonesome. And this is something that my mom described to me and told me I would know one day.
She wasn't trying to be mean. She just knew, and she wanted me to be prepared. We keep going, because that is what we do, and it's what we have to do. Still, in this loss, I'm incredibly fortunate and privileged. I work with my aunties. I work with my brothers and sisters. I work with my friends on recovery in Tagish Koshe and Dakwenje, Tan Kwachan Kwenje. I am privileged to have these people in this language. I am privileged to have my family, Egrachlan, in these episodes of Words and Culture. Soko Sunny Denat E. You take good care of yourselves out there.